So at the end of this cycle, what I would like to do is review a couple of philosophical questions. The objective of this course was to think about a philosophy of evolution and to get some tools for thinking about that. A few thinkers, seers, and poets in the last century have compared the goals of poetry, philosophy, and religion, have spoken about poetry and philosophy being very closely aligned with respect to their aims. Those philosophers and poets who speak that way are not the academic philosophers. They're the most creative minds who are the most eager to grasp truth and to vivify knowledge. As Whitehead said in the beginning of this course, to create the values that give civilization its life and its meaning. Those are the aims of poetry and philosophy. And in other times of history, religion. And in other times, occultism and magic. So when we speak about the possibility of a philosophy of evolution, we do that because the question of evolution is prominent in our consciousness. And the fact that Sri Aurobindo, in the last 10 years of his life, after 30 years of his spiritual practice, after his realization of the Overmind, devoted an enormous amount of energy to this question of evolution. As I've said a few times, the new chapters of The Life Divine, which were written in 1939 and 1940, are all about evolution. From the most structural, mechanistic concepts to the most psychological, to the most spiritual, in an endeavor to bring this question of evolution to its fullest possible formulation at this stage of the human development. So one of the things that one of the tools that we come across in the philosophy of evolution are these many chapters, about 10 chapters or 12 chapters of The Life Divine, that dwell upon this question. What is it? What is its meaning? How does it work? Why? Why is nature functioning in this way. So that indicates that it's a worthwhile endeavor to learn to think about evolution and to know really what it means. It's not just a concept in a magazine or something that biologists do. It's an approach to understanding existence. It's a framework for grasping the true meaning of reality, for learning to think correctly, to be conscious on all of our levels in a focused, intentional way. Because as Bergson discovered in the early part of the century, the last century, it requires this understanding of reality, and especially the question of evolution, requires the evolution of consciousness. It's not something that's well understood. It's something that began to be understood in the last 150 years. And in the last 50 years, it has taken enormous strides, this pursuit. And that's why you read about it in The Economist and in National Geographic, and hear about it in Oroville. It's not finished, neither the understanding of it nor the process itself. So it could be a key. The philosophy of evolution could be a key to many things. Not least of all, the revitalization of our civilization, the unleashing of meaningful creative forces. That was certainly Sri Aurobindo's idea, that by understanding this thing, we bring into play new powers of it. We make evolution more conscious of itself by aligning ourselves with its meaning, its importance, its value. So the question of value is paramount in pursuing a philosophy of evolution. What are our values? What is valuable? What is really worthwhile? And what gives it its value? So that's one perspective on the question of the philosophy of evolution. It brings also into focus, when we ask this question, the whole range of the human being's attempt to understand himself. And that is the subject of philosophy proper, the proper study and pursuit of philosophy. And so when we study Plato and Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas and Locke and Hume, we're also trying to come to terms with questions like, what is knowledge? What is the purpose of life? How does it work? How does mind play in this picture? Where does it come from? What is its scope? The scope of mind, the scope of life, the functions of matter. How is it that we become enlightened, vital, physical minds capable of blessing nature and humanity and functioning at this extraordinary, almost divine level in this material envelope? So the Greeks were interested in that question because there were many mystics in Greek civilization, and the idea of dematerializing and rematerializing the body and ascending through all the planes of consciousness and transforming matter were there in the Neoplatonic schools of thought. The idea of the Christ was that there could become a kind of human existence that was divine when there was some kind of meeting of spirit and matter. So this way of thinking about the origin and the purpose and how it all works is basically the subject of philosophy, and also where philosophy shades into religion and where it shades into poetry. It's a human endeavor to raise consciousness. So then we come to some specific questions of philosophy that are affected by the science of evolution. It is said, for example, that Darwin has made obsolete the concept of essentialism. So let's think about that for a minute. We were exposed to this concept in the ideas of Aristotle, and they have their origins in Plato. And Eastern philosophy is permeated with this idea of essentialism. So what it means is that when we know something, what we know is not the matter of the thing. What we know is the idea of the thing. We know abstractly what it is. So we recognize this filming object sitting on the tripod here. We know that that is not a living being from outer space who is invading our private club here. It's a camera on a tripod. And it has the form of a camera, it has the function of a camera, and in our mind it is exactly that idea that we have of a digital video recording device. When we know that, we do not know the mechanisms as they are turning. We do not know in detail the chip which is in there and how the chip stores the light signals that the camera is picking up. We don't know how elephants work or how societies work. We just know that they are, and we know what they are. Languages. We know what languages are. We've been studying more or less how they work, but if you really think about it, we don't know how they work at all. Language is a miraculous thing. We can analyze it to pieces and determine its structures, but the fact is that language is quite an extraordinary phenomenon. And so evolutionary life is an extraordinary phenomenon. The processes of variation and diversification and selection, which we have learned are going on constantly, is an extraordinary phenomenon. We can call that, we can give a lot of those processes names. When we see them repeated, when we see patterns being repeated, we give them names and we recognize them whenever they occur. So we have a kind of abstract, formal knowledge of what things are. And Aristotle calls this the form. It's the form that we know. We know the form elephant. We know the form healing. We know the form Ionic poetry. But how the healing takes place, how the poetry is created, how the shrew becomes the elephant or the pig, we don't really know any of these things in their actual becoming. We know their essence. So this word essence is what we grasp of the meaning of the thing. The form of the thing is the essence. Aristotle calls it essence, form, definition. And so for modern science, the idea of evolution was shocking because there is this idea that elephants don't evolve. They just are. Human beings are. Apple trees are. They are species. Another word for essence comes from eidos, idea. The eidos is the species, the type, the form, and it's what we know. And our minds are full of these concepts or forms, and we think that that's what things are. And then evolutionary science comes along and takes a good look at embryonics and paleontological changes through eons of time, and we find out that 99.9 species, ideas, forms that everyone thought were eternal no longer exist on Earth. And not only do we find out that all these forms that were thought to be eternal no longer exist on Earth, but they each were created by a process from previous forms. And it was a very gradual, incremental process. This is shocking to the mind, which for thousands of years has been convinced that forms are the essence of the thing, and that what we know is it. So So in the 20th century, as a result of the shock of evolutionary theory, philosophers began to point out that this concept of knowledge, this knowing that we're so proud of, actually is not what's there. It's not what's happening. What's happening is process. So if we look at the history of philosophy, we can see that in Aristotle's time, his idea was that process, matter, is totally determined by form. Form pre-exists eternally. What the bird is and what the bird does from the time of its birth to the time of its death is due to the form of the bird. What birds do what they're supposed to do. They know how to build nests. They know how to feed their young. The doctor knows how to heal. And from the moment that he meets the patient until the patient is cured is healing. So these forms are attracting and propelling what exists into its natural mode. So Aristotle calls that the cause, the final cause, and everything that happens along the way are either material causes or efficient causes. So when you strike the match to the candle, it starts to burn and it lights the room. But striking the match to the candle is not really what's happening. Lighting the room is what's happening. So it's just fulfilling the purpose of the candle. It's why we struck the match to start with. We wanted the candle to illuminate the room. So the form is always there in the fulfillment of that which is becoming. So societies, you know, there's the Greek society is in the process of becoming the ruler of the world, and everything else just falls into place because that's its destined pattern, and Alexander the Great is its primary instrumentation. But he is just the instrument for the realization of that totality of being, which is the Greek civilization or the Roman civilization. So then we find ourselves faced with the idea that the evolutionary scientific idea that things are not, these forms are just in our minds. They are abstractions. What things actually are is determined from moment to moment by their evolution. And every pattern of behavior is the product of previous patterns of behavior, and every structure is the product of previous behaviors and patterns. These are transmitted through heredity and through language and culture and behavior. The phenotype finds its niche, and then the genotype tends to evolve in a way that preserves that behavior in that niche. There's a correspondence between behavior and what the genes do. The behavior actually selects the genes. The genes don't select the behavior. The genes create the structure which makes the behavior possible. And if that behavior works, then those genes get passed on. If that behavior doesn't work, then those genes don't get passed on. But they make possible a wide range of behaviors. And so if some other behaviors work better, then another genetic pattern can be selected, because those members of the group that have that possibility are more successful, and those who had the other possibilities drop out. And so there's a constant communication going on between structure and form. And what's determining it? Well, Darwin says what's determining it is one fundamental principle, and that is that nature selects those types that are best able to sustain themselves in the context of the existing environment, in the existing web of life. And as soon as some variation can sustain itself more successfully, it replaces those that are less successful. And so the flight of birds, which in itself is as amazing as language, came about through a gradual process of adaptation, variation, selection from lizards and reptiles. Yeah. So, what do we do with this new information? We are told by the Darwinians that essentialism, and they're very strong on this point, essentialism has been shown to be not true. There are not eternal, pre-existent essences or forms. There are ideas which we have about things which are forms and essences. And so then there's a major change in philosophy which comes about. This, the idea that we create concepts because of some relationship that we have with things through perception. We create concepts and we test those and we measure them against the patterns that we perceive and what other people perceive, and we agree about these forms and behaviors that exist. And then Bergson tells us, but we are creating a framework of understanding that we agree upon, but it is not at all that world of process that is ongoing, that is ever-changing, that is the real creative force of life that has produced consciousness out of matter and that has the possibility of evolving a more dynamic, luminous truth consciousness, which would enable us to really know our world and be completely in sympathy with it, because we are continuous with it. We are not abstracting it and formulating it and operating formulas. We can be, he says, one with this world, because we are that physical and that vital and that mental force. And because we've discovered that our rational mentality is not the whole picture, it doesn't tell us the truth about things much of the time, It enables us to manipulate things, but our manipulations of things are only partially successful. So mind has evolved, and it is finding a way to create our longevity. It is helping us to reproduce our type. But it has limits. And it doesn't prevent us from behaving in quite unacceptable ways at times. And some of those ways of behavior begin at certain points to threaten our existence. We are threatening our own survival by some of our behaviors. And so there began to emerge two things here. One was a critique of knowledge based upon scientific understanding, moving away from essentialism towards process, and a questioning, a fundamental questioning of consciousness itself. What is it? How does it work? Since Aristotle, everyone assumed that consciousness was just a part of nature. It has emerged in mind, and it knows the world that it perceives in terms of forms. Lo and behold, those forms are not telling us the truth about the world that we perceive. They're only concepts. And this world is changing at every moment. And we have some responsibility as members of it to make decisions about nature. And we don't have to just accept that one civilization is from time to time rising and another one is taking over it and it's falling. And we live according to the patterns of our society's values as best we can and take the consequences, and then we're replaced by another set of patterns and entities, and suddenly we step back from all of that and question its meaning, and we question the limitations to our ability to understand its meaning. And then science does what Sri Aurobindo predicted that it would do. It starts to focus on meaning. And so we have physicists like Roger Penrose, especially today, and previously Schrodinger and others, asking this question of consciousness. And then we get, in the last 10 years or so, a philosopher like Daniel Dennett, who wrote this book called Darwin's Dangerous Idea, discussing these things which I'm now discussing. And saying incredibly interesting things from a philosophical standpoint about evolution and about the limitations of consciousness. He wrote a book called Consciousness Explained. And then he wrote Darwin's Dangerous Idea. And then he wrote Freedom Evolves. And so we have a so-called ultra-Darwinian, someone who is absolutely against the notion of essentialism, saying words like, "There is simply no denying the breathtaking brilliance of the designs to be found in nature." Time and again, biologists, baffled by some apparently futile or maladroit bit of bad design in nature, have eventually come to see that they have underestimated the ingenuity, the sheer brilliance, the depth of insight to be discovered in one of Mother Nature's creations. Darwin shows us how to climb from absolute ignorance to creative genius without begging any questions. But we must tread very carefully among the controversies that swirl around us. Most, if not all, consist of different challenges to Darwin's claim that he can take us all the way to here from there. That the theory of natural selection, of nature's ability to operate unconsciously, but not unintelligently, throughout millennia, from the inconscient to this consciousness and beyond. This, they say, the ultra-Darwinians, is enough for us to know that mind is there in matter, that life is there in matter, that evolution is a process of nature bringing out step by step through processes of cognition, of transfer of information between the genome and the environment through the phenome, exactly what can happen within the constraints of what has already happened and what needs to happen next. And according to these ultra-Darwinians, there is a constant, ongoing process of adaptation between these three levels of the environment, the phenome, and the genome, through exchanges of information. And so in 1973, we get an evolutionary biologist named Lorenz treating the most fundamental level of material organization as a level of cognition. And so this insight that Sri Aurobindo had when he was questioning evolution in 1920, and which he eventually formulated in great detail in 1940, this idea that matter, life, and mind are emerging from the basic fundamental structure of nature, has been generally accepted now. The question is whether process itself can explain it adequately. And so the reason why that question arises is because if we step back from process and we look at what it produces, not just how it produces it, but if we look at what it produces, and we look at something like language, which is such an extraordinary phenomenon, or if we look at something simpler, like the 40 completely, totally unrelated different paths that evolution has taken to develop eyes, to develop sight. Sight is not one continuous evolution. It is many, many different experiments of nature have produced sight. And if we look at the fact that every exchange of energy, of information from the simplest organism to the most complex is, can be shown to be a process of cognition, because information does get exchanged and it does influence behavior. Then we think, perhaps cognition is itself so extraordinary, sight is so extraordinary, the fact that it happens, that we see, that beings, that organisms see, and that organisms behave according to information that they accumulate at every level, then we have to ask the question, what is it that is evolving here? Is it only structure and process and function? Or is it consciousness that is evolving here? Are all of these different levels of physical and vital and mental forms and structures and behaviors producing consciousness, or produced by consciousness for its progressive formation and emergence? Then we find out that philosophy has been asking this question for quite a long time. And I brought the other day Locke's book, but I find the essential passages have been quoted by Dennett in this book. So just to think for a minute about how this question was viewed by John Locke in 1690, he said this: if there must be something eternal, now let's think philosophically about that. Must there be something eternal? Well, things have to start somewhere. Everything has to start somewhere. How can there be something starting somewhere if there was not something already started before it? Something doesn't come from nothing. Matter cannot come from nothing. It must come from something, or it must have always been there. So this idea of eternity has been around for a long time. It makes the most common sense. So if there must be something eternal, let us see what sort of being it must be. And to that, it is very obvious to reason that it must necessarily be a cogitative being, for it is impossible to conceive that ever bare incogitative matter should produce a thinking, intelligent being. It is impossible to conceive of that as that nothing should of itself produce matter. How can nothing produce anything? And how can matter itself, just matter, electrons and protons, produce intelligence? Intelligence is of a different order than matter. It's about ideas and memory and conscious, purposeful action. It's not just about exchanges of energy. So, this argument has been around since 1690. And then we see Sri Aurobindo here on the screen saying, an originative or an original creative or evolutionary power there must be. But although matter is the first substance, the original and ultimate power is not an inconscient material energy, for then life and consciousness would be absent, since inconscience cannot evolve consciousness. Nor an inanimate force evolve life. There must be, therefore, since mind and life also are not that, a secret consciousness greater than life consciousness or mind consciousness, an energy more essential than the material energy. Since it is greater than mind, it must be a supramental consciousness force. Since it is a power of essential substance other than matter, it must be the power of that which is the supreme essence and substance of all things, a power of the spirit. So if we conceive of something powerful enough to create matter, which is eternal, necessarily, then, says Sri Aurobindo, that power is what produces material consciousness, vital consciousness, mental consciousness, spiritual consciousness, and supramental consciousness. It was there from the beginning, and it will be there in form at the end. So all of those forms along the way are not the thing that's eternal. All of those concepts that were there along the way is not the thing that's eternal. All of those things are changing all the time. All the structures, all the forms, all the artistic expressions, all the philosophical formulations, however beautiful and comprehensive they are at any moment, are in process. The only thing that's eternal is spirit. But it can create progressively higher, more complex embodiments of itself. And it is not other than nature. And so Sri Aurobindo says periodically, spirit and matter are the same. And the surrender that happens is the surrender to Prakriti. Purusha surrenders to Prakriti because it is that energy in motion which by itself has the power to create everything. The Purusha believes that it sanctions things from time to time. But it can only sanction what is. The self is. And its energy is what it can become. And so to make that transition from mind to supermind, now that we've understood all of these things, Sri Aurobindo says it is absolutely necessary for mind, the mind level of consciousness force, to give itself up, to step aside, to abdicate. Because that energy of mind, which we are now organizing, is not the next stage of evolution. It doesn't have the creative power. It doesn't have the truth. It has a kind of organizing capacity which has served the survival of humanity fairly well up till now. And it has evolved much faster than lower forms of life because the life evolution took more time and energy to work itself out. The physical evolution took even more than that. It was much slower. So Sri Aurobindo describes these levels of evolution, each of which gets not only more complex but more rapid in its and more diverse in its rapidity of diversity, diversification. So we are infinitely diverse, capable of uniting all of our consciousnesses with all of the consciousnesses of nature, because it's only one. If we abdicate this idea of formal difference, we begin to then allow to emerge a continuum of consciousness that operates from another center, an impersonal center, not from the one that has evolved through the processes of evolution so far, but the one that will evolve through the new processes of evolution. It's not the mind consciousness that is diversified in humanity that's the next stage. It is the supramental, which is another center that creates for itself bodies who experience themselves as an infinite diversity of that one power, that one truth, that one beauty, that one infinite potential. So, if that was what was intended from the beginning, says Sri Aurobindo, then it is inevitable at the end. And there are processes which he elaborates, which Darwin didn't elaborate, which Darwin was not aware of, and which Daniel Dennett is not aware of. But he is pushing the envelope when he says that freedom evolves and that the normal intelligence of human beings at this point cannot solve all of its ethical problems. Therefore, another level of intelligence is bound to emerge. And he says one of the signs of this is that human beings now are able to impose their will on their own functioning, on their own group functioning, in order to change behavior, which is not necessarily a benefit to the reproduction of the individual. Whereas in the past, that was always the main measure. So it's possible to sacrifice species, the normal methods of species survival through reproduction, in order to achieve a more harmonious social structure, and so women have fewer children. Men go into celibate life and devote 40 years in isolation to formulating the life divine. This, according to previous stages of Darwinian evolution, is not a viable way to ensure that the race improves. But it is a viable way to ensure that the race improves, and Sri Aurobindo says at some point it must become universal, that those powers that he achieved through those processes must become the norm, and will become the norm. And every philosophical effort and poetic effort and psychological transformational effort that human beings make is a part of that, the emergence of that norm, those new norms that are emerging under evolutionary stress, otherwise known as the will of the divine. In this conception, there is no difference. The divine is not something outside which is willing things abstractly. The divine is totally involved here, willing things from inside, and not just some things, but everything. And so knowing that, one can cease from being judgmental, because this is not better than that. This is that. It's possible to affirm everything. And that was Nietzsche's message. Why don't we say yes? Why doesn't humanity say yes and rise above all of its nonsense as a result of saying yes, instead of trying to repress everything to which it's saying no? So the idealism gets turned upside down, and it's possible to affirm the material, the sensuous, the intellectual. There's a huge section in The Life Divine where Sri Aurobindo says it is absolutely essential to develop the intellect, and especially the philosophical mind, to its limits in order for this new level of consciousness to descend. And he puts that above the occult and the religious, which are also useful and have been. But he says it's absolutely essential in this transition to develop this philosophical mind to its limits as a channel for that descent. But then it has to be able to abdicate. So this poetic, philosophical affirmation of the values of existence carries one to that point of full realization of the human potential, at which point it's able to abdicate to another potential. But not until then. Until then, it's just turning around in its already established vital mental patterns, which can go on indefinitely. So this concept of descent, imposing the higher consciousness on the lower members and bringing the lower members up to that level, Sri Aurobindo says, has been going on all the time. That the vital force in nature was doing exactly that. The phenome, the behavioral type, is seeking more energetic patterns, and when it finds them, those patterns are imposed upon the lower vital and physical formations. Natural selection steps in and reinforces the choices that are being made by the vital intelligence in the phenome. What is the time? I don't have a 6:40. So there are some processes that Sri Aurobindo has addressed that had not been addressed by conventional Darwinians, but they don't contradict in any way the Darwinian perspective. And the Darwinian perspective would feel threatened by the idea that there is a universal vital intelligence which is pressing on the physical to bring out its potentials, or that there's a universal mental consciousness force that is pressing upon the vital, and a universal supramental force that is pressing upon the mental to bring out the new formations, because that's not something that we can see. And so the fundamental change that Sri Aurobindo calls for is that science learn to step back from sensory data and apply the same rigorousness to the psychological, psycho-spiritual data that it gets from inside. And when science begins to do that, he says, science itself will discover the mechanisms. And so we have today people like Roger Penrose asking questions from the physicist's point of view about the physics of consciousness and saying that our scientific methodology isn't adequate to answer the question. Science itself has to evolve new methodologies and will evolve them necessarily. And he's the one who discovered the Big Bang. So this question of evolution is a question for biology, and it's a question for psychology, and it's a question for philosophy, and it is a question for spirituality. It is a process of reconnecting the material and the mental and higher mental and intuitive and spiritual levels of consciousness. That's a continuum. Material consciousness is in us, spiritual consciousness is in us. Becoming conscious of the processes of evolution is putting those levels in direct contact with each other and becoming an evolutionary consciousness and making choices with a full knowledge of what the vital tendency would be, what the mental tendency would be, what the physical limitations would be, and what the descending force can do within those constraints. And continually putting the levels in contact with each other, allowing them to interface, and not settling into a habit that comes from eons of physical behavior, or eons of vital behavior, or centuries of mental behavior. They all have their range and validity, but not allowing the being to drift into one of those habitual patterns because it seems right, or it feels good, or it's what everyone else is doing. Sacrifice means putting these levels in contact with each other and allowing them to ignite. So the philosophy of evolution can possibly further this project, the project of the transcendence of the human. So this has been a summary going from Darwin and Haeckel to Bergson and Sri Aurobindo to Dawkins and Dennett, just to create a framework for thinking philosophically about evolution. In the future, and perhaps in our Saturday seminars, if we revive those, we can carry further the poetry, the philosophy, the linguistics, the pursuit of integral consciousness, because the supramental is the integral. It integrates all of these levels and fully develops each of them. It doesn't negate any of them. But how to bring that about is a question of education, of discovery, of art, of science. So if we wish to do so, we could reassemble this group and members of the previous semester's Integral Paradigm Group and attempt to define a path for the discovery of a dynamic evolutionary consciousness, an integral approach to knowledge, a platform for self-development, which includes all approaches. And then we step away from this framing of concepts and enter into dialogue. But on the basis of some common understanding, because that has to be created. The idea of an intersubjective reality, which is a popular German idea in philosophy, it's been evolving for 50 years or so, from phenomenology to a kind of ontological, sociological view, that an intersubjective reality is the product of language and intention shared by a group of human beings to the point that they know what they're talking about, they know what their values are, they are resonant, and they can afford to take risks together because they know that they all basically understand what the constraints are, what the goals are, and how to interact in a rational, sane way, and on the basis of that stability, they can risk taking some steps outside of the box. But it's very difficult in a society where people don't share values and language. So the mother wants to see created here an international, intercultural society which develops a common language and ideals. And then it's possible to bring into play histories of divergences in the human phenome that otherwise can't be brought into a convergence, because the world is perpetuating all of those separate ideologies and languages and cultures. So why not create a laboratory of evolution where those converge into a common framework of language and value, which has the intention of not perpetuating all of the old ones, but using their richness to launch something else. Time to go. So, I think that we could start a new Saturday series based upon a platform of discovery with that general intention. We'll try to do that. Does anybody have some suggestions about how to go about it, which would be different from what we've done before and more interesting? We could take more than that. We could shoot for the middle of January, for example. But between now and then, we could keep these things in mind, and we have a website called University of Human Unity, not the. And it is possible through the through my philosophy of evolution or Vladimir's linguistics or, you know, any of those already existing formats, to just send messages if you want to, or pick up the telephone or send an email. And you know, we wanted to develop that website so that an idea like this could get formulated and announced fairly efficiently. But so far the website hasn't worked like that. There hasn't been a lot of exchange going on. I think 6 people registered in the Philosophy of Evolution group. And there are obviously 18 of us, so it hasn't caught on yet. This is one reason why we must do the seminars, because we are not at a point yet where we can diversify and just communicate through the internet. There has to be a physical gathering.
This group could at least have an email contact, just a mass mail.
Is there anyone here who has not registered on the website? Do you have a computer?
Yeah, but the internet is down most of the time.
So most people have registered, it looks like. The last time I looked there, there were only five or six. But
one of the problems is ignorance. I mean, I know myself that I'm here to learn from you. You've taught so much. The very beginning things I knew a little bit about in the dark and day before, but you know, the rest of the stuff, wow, you know. So who am I to give? I want to take.
No, but when we get into an interactive workshop, then we find out that actually everyone has plenty to give and plenty to take, and there's much more available there than one person can do. And so we, our experience has been that someone can start with a theme, but through the process of interaction, other themes emerge quickly and get formulated quite effectively and luminously sometimes.
But it means also time from this to get all the information. You have so many other duties already.
Right.
And that I think when we have this class, more and more it comes in, more and more we study, have time, and then can this interaction evolve out of it.
Yeah, it will evolve. The question is, what is the very next step? This incremental Darwinian approach, you know. We meet, what is the second Saturday in January? Someone have a calendar handy? I don't know, I haven't seen a January calendar yet. All of mine are running out in December.
Tenth? Yeah,
the 17th. Okay, let's, what? 17th is better than the 10th? I like the 10th. 1-10-09.
The 17th,
so 17th is?
Yeah, there's a Tamil New Year on the 14th, and then 15th, 16th, 17th.
Okay, why don't we have an exploratory general session on the 10th? And try to formulate some predetermined focuses for, let's say, 6 weeks. Look at that formulation on the 10th, and then launch on the 17th. Vladimir, what do you think?
Yes, I also. I think we will do that. We can Upanishads we continue the course anyhow because it is going on. There's much to which is at the beginning.
Well, on Wednesday if you
feel. Right. And regarding linguistics, if you want to look into those in detail, then we can also have our time and do that.
On Monday?
I'm not sure about Monday. We can do it on Saturdays, but we can do it also on Mondays if there would be a call for it.
I think that if that we could make that a feature of a few Saturdays, we can make evolution a feature of a few Saturdays. We can make integral psychology.
Question and answers and all kinds of inquiries and bringing. Because one thing is to present the idea, another is to absorb the idea.
There is a work, a study, that's that deserves exploration, which I just wanted to show this one. One possible study. The basis of an exploration could be this book. It's very rich and interesting and relevant. And so if we start to look at integral psychology, as an educational tool, then there are several chapters in this book that are pertinent to developing an integral psychological approach to education. And there are many things that connect to that.
When did you write that?
2 years back.
Is it still online?
Yeah. You can order it from Amazon. So, you know, there's a very interesting scope for exploration. Howard Gardner's work can be explored. So let's think about that for the future and meet in a few weeks.